Gleich geht's los mit dem On the Way to New Work Podcast. Habt einen kleinen Moment Geduld. Unser Werbepartner für diesen ersten Block ist mein eigenes Unternehmen Blackboat. Es geht nochmal um das Blackboat Bootcamp, das New Work Bootcamp, bei dem wir in 2 Tagen geballtes Wissen vermitteln aus den Projekten, die wir mit unseren Kunden gemacht haben in den vergangenen Jahren. Es geht ganz konkret um die Tools, es geht um Technologie, es geht um People und Kultur. Wie bringe ich das alles zusammen in einem Unternehmen? Wie baue ich ein Projekt auf? Wie setze ich es um? Wir gehen super konkret rein mit unserem Tool, der Collaboration Performance Map, arbeiten dadurch neu dazu. In diesem Jahr kommt das Thema Workspace, weil das für uns ein Tool ist. Das Büro ist für uns ein Kommunikationstool, ein wichtiges. Dazu gibt es ein paar sehr coole Speaker. Jetzt keine zu große Eigenwerbung. Ich habe Michael überredet, dass er auf jeden Fall dabei ist. Das heißt, er und ich stehen auf jeden Fall auf der Bühne und erzählen etwas aus den Erfahrungen zum Thema New Work. Wir haben aber auch weitere Speaker, die dazukommen. Aber ihr werdet auch sehr, sehr, sehr konkret arbeiten an den Themen, um New Work, um Digitales in eure Unternehmen zu bringen und ein Projekt aufzusetzen. Wir haben große Unternehmen dabei, kleine Unternehmen dabei, Einzelpersonen dabei, ist alles mit dabei, aber die Plätze sind limitiert. Wir wollen nämlich wirklich mit euch arbeiten in den 2 Tagen. Schaut auf die Seite blackboat.com/bootcamp. Blackboat schreibt man B-L-A-C-K-B-O-A-T, also wie englisches Boot, blackboat.com/bootcamp. Dort findet ihr alle Informationen und wichtig, bis zum 1. April bekommt ihr den Early Bird Preis. Das sind, wie gesagt, 2 Tage geballtes Wissen. Das gibt's sonst nicht. Das machen wir normalerweise in den Projekten. So, genug der Worte. Ich hoffe, das ist alles soweit klar. Ach so, sorry OMR. Eine Sache machen wir noch. Wir kopieren von euch selbstverständlich die Idee. Falls ihr einen Chef habt, der nicht will, dass ihr da hingeht, dann helfen wir euch mit den Argumenten. Das fanden wir so großartig. Natürlich machen wir das. Was für ein geiler Service. Aber das ist eine Idee, die kommt von OMR. Also, blackboat.com/bootcamp und dann jetzt viel Spaß mit der neuen Folge. Willkommen zum On the Way to New Work Podcast mit
Michael Tautmann
und Christoph Magnussen. And we switch to English now. Although we're still in Berlin, it's Monday, it's sunny, it's nice. But we sit here with Sean Ardeis and Imran Rehman. Actually, a German name, Rehman. That's what we discussed about already.
Yeah, it's not though. It's just that my father arrived in the UK with his name and he said Urechman. And the English Beamter or civil servants heard the word Raymond.
And then
it became a European name.
Awesome. And you guys are the founders of Kokoro. So, we will talk about, I heard, agile work, how work is changing, because that's what you guys are working on, but we're most likely interested in your personal story in the beginning. What brought you here?
Wow, so should I start, Sean?
Please.
Yeah, cool. What brought me here was my heart. My partner is actually Viennese, and I moved to Vienna, where I met Sean. And that's what got me into the German environment. It was always love. And my first love, who is not my love anymore, was from Mainz, near Frankfurt.
Cool.
And Wiesbaden. So I met her in Spain while I was working for Price Waterhouse back then. And that's how I got into the German language, the German semantic, the German literature, German rap music, and everything else that's German. You know, bread, Wurst, and everything else which makes Germany or the German speakers German.
Cool. Yeah, I'm also following my family here. So this is about 3 years now since I've been in Vienna. Moved from Silicon Valley. So born and raised in Silicon Valley and have been in this digitalization space since I guess 2001 now. So when I came here and people were like, oh, you know, digitalization is a new big thing. I was like, maybe. You mean you guys don't do it that way here? It's like, what's going on? So it was fun. First kids. But I'm back and forth. I have a, you know, very, very connected in the Silicon Valley still, and still lots of friends there and keeping up with where that's headed and try to apply some of that here in what we're doing. So. The good parts of it, at least.
I'm a big fan of this area. I have friends there. So where exactly do you came from there?
I was born and raised in Santa Clara. So my mom lives still a few blocks from the Apple campus. Mm-hmm. I went to Santa Clara University right there. Mm-hmm. And I went to graduate school in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So I spent the last 6 years in San Francisco and built an innovation strategy firm there as well. I was there for about two and a half years. So I did a lot of this kind of work, the new work or innovation work, as you call it, or whatever, trying to figure out how to change mindsets, change cultures, bring in ideas of creativity and new ways of being and doing. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
What's your background, Imran?
I'm like a good Asian boy should be. I became a lawyer. Or a doctor or an engineer. I was born, I came out of my mother. They looked at my fat, happy face.
It's not bad. I got it in. It's heavy.
And
Very nice picture.
Thank you. It's okay. And as they saw my face, they said, "You're going to be the lawyer." And my...
Yeah, because you look very trustful. Yeah.
Well, I come from a family full of lawyers. A lot of women in our family are lawyers. And it became a part which I really enjoyed in my studies. I started studying law at the age of 16 and went through until I finished. And it was fantastic from the logic, the semantic, the language, understanding complexity. And it taught me something. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't a lawyer in my heart. So I was truthful to myself and came home and told my parents I wasn't a lawyer. And then the matrix came down on me. And if you know the Indian families, they start, and you know, we're not only Indian, we're Pakistani, we're Afghani, we're African, we're a bit of a mix. And they all came down on me. But I held my course and realized that as a lawyer, there's skills that can be used in lots of other areas.
So you actually never worked as a lawyer, but...
I did for a little while for Price Waterhouse in Spain, because I met one of the partners while out and about in Madrid, where I lived for four and a half years. And like you sometimes do a job interview when you meet somebody. I was interviewed and I got a job, and it was about showing them how to create like bridges between the offices in the UK and America. They wanted to understand more about the English legal system. And I understood, I specialized in constitutional, international, and accounting law. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it was just I just had the knowledge in my head fresh out of university.
Yeah.
So it was really, really good. I became sort of a semi-lecturer stroke coach, because there was lots of conflicts between the partners. And that led me into where I am today, really.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, maybe we start with your product, because I think the product description says a lot about your fundamental beliefs. Maybe we start with this, and then we enter the area of So what is it all about? What's the core idea? What's the elevator pitch, and what's it in a little bit longer story?
Sure. Do you want to go for that one? Because you've been really good on the product lately. Because we've been
absolutely working. Well, Kokoro, you know, it's Japanese for heart mind integration, and we were looking for a name, and we had tons of words on the wall, and we were trying to figure out what is it that we embody, what is it that we're trying to communicate across through not just ourselves and what we embody on a daily basis, but what we want the tool to do, and what we want teams to be. And when we saw Kokoro and we started reading more about it, we're like, that's it, you know. And we're looking at actually just, it's heart, mind, and soul, actually. And when you bring this idea of Kokoro into a tool, what we're trying to do essentially is to evolve teams, yeah, to the highest level that they can evolve to, mm-hmm. or whatever that means, yeah. We see teams as the cornerstone for organizational success. It's not individuals anymore, because of the complexity and the ambiguity and the speed in which things go. We need really teams to operate at really high levels. And I don't think that people really know what that means yet. Yeah. I think that they think they know, but I don't think they've experienced it yet. Because when you experience it, you don't go back. Yeah, and you know. And it's hard to put your mind on. It's hard to put your finger on. But when you know, and you don't know what that is and what that magic is. And so we're trying to kind of decode that magic and allow teams to kind of experience that for themselves. So it's a tool to basically quickly analyze teams and help them evolve to higher performance. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And the only thing I will really add to that is one of the things we're also looking at is there's one aspect of how do you do it in a way that it adapts to the team as the team moves? Because you're on the go. Mm-hmm. If you keep using the same methodology daily, like you do with a questionnaire, then it would be at one point, it will not be a, it would not measure the team. Because the team, you know, yesterday, your company yesterday is not the company today. Mm-hmm. So your company changes daily and teams change daily. So how could you make it adaptive? Mm-hmm. And then what one measurement in biofeedback you could use that could help to maybe visualize the energy of the team at the same time? Mm-hmm. So what measurement in the human body can we take, like you measure the engine of a car, that will give us a true reflection of where we are from a quality and intensity of energy? I find that fascinating, extremely fascinating.
But sounds like a big challenge. I mean,
yeah. It is because it scares people at the same time. It gets people fascinated. At the same time, we know that the technology, I had to wait for the technology. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I had this idea 15, 20 years ago when I was running teams, when I was leading teams and saying to HR, build me a tool that will help teams move.
Wow.
And they were not listening. They were telling me to leave because I didn't have enough gray hair.
Probably they think, well, they thought, and I'm pretty sure that many people in leading positions believe, put people into a room, give them a planning tool and some paperwork, and then they are a team. So just by putting them together, they believe it's a team.
Because they report,
as we know, it's not a team.
Because they report to a hierarchy.
Yeah.
So they become the hierarchical team.
Yeah.
And because they come from families, they think they know what a unit feels like.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that at all.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that at all.
Interesting. So when you talk about a hierarchical team, compare that to a family, what do you guys see? Like what is the experience that you want to...
Let me tell you this way around, with all the coaching I've done, I've met lots of leaders in highly complex matrix organizations. That's where I come from. And one of the things I realized was I had some key events in my childhood which became very apparent to me later on. One was I went to 26 schools before I was 16.
Wow. 26.
That was because of my father was very ill and we followed him around hospitals around the UK. So we continuously, every 3 months, we changed school.
Wow.
That was one aspect. I didn't know the benefit of that until much later. There was a lot of confusion until I worked out that benefit. But the interesting part was that in my family, I reported to maybe 4 direct heads. So I didn't only have my parents, but aunties and uncles who were there, then also maybe 24 dotted line functional heads. So from the minute I could talk, I was reporting daily to multiple people. That got me ready for a matrix organization and how it works. Mm-hmm. And now to answer your question, can you see what is missing in a lot of people? Missing is the wrong word. What people are not aware of when they're working in very fast moving, high complex environments where all the people are trying to do their best. Can you see what's missing there? You cannot work with the way you see teams work in university because you've done one seminar paper with a team. Mm. You can't just go out and say, well, I played in a football team, now I'm going to go in there. Yeah, the problem is you play one football match, then you can think about it. In business, there are...
multiple matches at the same time.
Exactly, Sean. Yeah. Multiple matches going at the same time. Multiple boat races going at the same time. And that sucks the... living daylights out of you. Your energy disappears and you're struggling on a daily basis to keep that energy up. And then what happens? You become a cholerica. That's one of the first German words I learned. A cholerica.
Oh,
you know, one of those bosses that shouts and screams the minute it becomes a bit stressful. Mm. And they think it's a personality trait because they do some sort of personality diagnosis and they realize that they are dominant. I'm a dominant person. I cannot help it.
Yeah. It's the way it is. Yeah. We had one podcast with her name was Jenny. She was from Dropbox, and she was a mixture between psychologist and designer, and was working at the interface. And one of her topics was to analyze the success factors of teams. And she and her team looked at totally different teams. In a hospital, doctors and medical workers, then into a Broadway production team, software team. So from every industry you can believe. And what they found out is, and I think this is what many people underestimate, the only factor which is really describing success of teams in every case is the relationships of the members.
So the quality of the relationship.
Yeah.
Not only, I think we found a few others as well.
So, I guess so.
yeah, looking at that. But safety is a huge component. Yeah, absolutely. It's an underlying component that is critical for any type of creative process or any type of really high-functioning team, and that's the baseline. If you don't have safety, if I'm not able to tell Imram, hey, you screwed up today, or vice versa, in a way that I don't feel like I'm being threatened or I have a fear of losing my job, we're not going to be able to create together or to bring the best out of each other. That's a huge issue for most organizations because of that hierarchical issue you're just talking about.
Exactly. And so if you've got safety and you've got the quality of interaction, what is the one thing you need to measure to ensure that that happens and that happens? Safety.
Communication
is always an excuse for me.
Okay.
Because you can't find any other word.
Okay.
It's a byproduct.
So that's what it's actually vulnerability. So one of the things that if you can start measuring vulnerability, if you could just imagine in a team measuring what is the quality of our vulnerability, then trust will emerge. If trust emerges, then interactions improve. And people get it the other way around. They think we've got to build trust before I can be vulnerable, before I can tell you, sorry, boss, I can't do this. Or sorry, my colleague, I know I'm a back end developer, but I've never built this sort of stack. I need somebody else's help. Mm-hmm. But before that, they think you need trust for that to happen. No, that has to happen first. So you trust me more.
Yeah, that's what I think.
It works on both, doesn't it, Sean?
What people realize when they come into problems and they start to talk about the problems with other people, they see that they will follow as well. And when they talk to them prior, then many of them say, well, how are you? Oh, it's good. It's great. And you don't really show your feelings. But if you open yourself and say, well, I have a really deep problem in my working environment, or I have a problem with my wife, then other people say, well, I had this 2 years ago. And I think it's, and then trust follows.
You create some intimacy is what it is. Yeah. You create a bond there. And when I see no differentiation between who I am as an individual and the team that I'm working with, I have got a deep level of intimacy or connection or overlap between that. I do anything for that team. Yeah. And that's the case. And the speed increases and the quality of work increases and all of those things. But we ignore all of these things at work. Yeah. There's no way to measure these kinds of things. And I think that's what Kokoro is trying to do. We're trying to get at the essence of how do we show up in these ways, and are we having the right kinds of conversations? Are we being asked about these things, or do people care about these things? And we say, yeah, they're very, very important. They increase there are all kinds of positive benefits for that. And let's make sure that we're having those conversations. Make sure we're looking at that data. Let's make sure that those things are on the table so that we can perform at a higher and higher level.
I find there's something which people always forget that, one story I got when I was a young boy was a story of a nurse who helped hospitals become what they are today. Florence Nightingale was an amazing nurse. What she did was she was the first person who visualized data and showed it to a leadership team in a hospital to show, look, we're losing more men and women in hospital during the war than actually outside on the front line. And through data visualization, she proved that. And with the right data, the data that mattered, that hygiene factors are the key indicator of hospital performance. And that's what we're facing again when we're coming to, whether it's new work, wherever we are in our historical sort of step to the next step, we need a different form of visualizing data. We need to measure the right data because we create a lot of noise. Mm. We're creating a lot of noise on our phones, on everything we use. Mm. And I think there's one major aspect about data. Well, if we can get the right data on the wall and integrate it with the data we have until today, and we've measured really good stuff from the early 60s, don't get me wrong. The KPIs, the key performance indicators we've used, are not all been bad. They really have helped us. I mean, we've used them. I grew up them. I had my first KPI at the age of 5 in the British school system, and we're very good at collecting KPIs in the UK. So now all we're saying is that, look, we've got 50% of the picture sorted. How about the other 50%? Mm-hmm. Why don't we add that as well?
Yeah, let's get a holistic picture of what's happening.
That's it, isn't it?
What are examples like of stuff that you would use as
a measure? I'll give you a really good example of a company in Munich at the moment. They are scaling. you know, they're successful. They're going from about 25, 30 people up to about 50. They already have a KPI dashboard. It's live. It's working. And now the main team is saying, Imran, we're going to be scaling 5, 10 people a month. They're scared. I said, what are you scared of? What's the fear? He says, well, we lose this feeling of community. We can't touch it. It's a tacit knowledge of the team. Mm-hmm. Is that when you put a glass on the table, the person's already pouring the water in. It's all these little sort of caring behaviors you see everywhere. And you say, well, how do you get hold of that community feeling within
a fast growing thing?
And what would you measure? And those things fascinate me. You know, how do you measure unity? How do you measure the quality of the interaction, caring interaction that's happening between people?
Safety.
Yeah. And safety. It could be safety as well. It could be feeling of belonging.
Which we're already many.
Yeah, you know, what are the behavioral cues that create the feeling of belonging?
Because the performance end is a byproduct of these things. Yeah. We're looking at the underlying driving motivators that bring people to work, that have them show up, that intrinsically want them to be there. Imran and I don't tell Imran, hey, you should be doing this today, or he should, you know, he doesn't tell me you should be doing this.
Well, this morning you
it's
said,
like there's something pulling me to action because I want to be here. Yeah. And I'm called to be here for a particular reason, and I know the value that I'm bringing. Yeah. And when we create these kinds of organizations or these kinds of networks, they move at unpredictably, they move extremely, extremely fast. Yeah, and this is where we need to head to, because of the problems that we have that we're facing and the speed in which we need to work.
Exactly. So I work with leadership a lot at the moment. I'm a leadership coach. I've done about 8,000 hours in over 60, 70 countries globally. And one of the things that this is one of my biggest sort of like really annoys me when I read articles in great magazines, whether it's Brand Eins or, you know, HRB, Harvard Business Review, Business Review. They have these six things you can do as a leader. Mm. And I'm like sitting there going, why don't we measure something in a group dynamic that actually forces this to happen instead of telling people? That would fascinate me. And that's what I keep, when I'm coaching leaders, one of the things they always do is say, and I'll create a list of the things we have to do. No, create the measure that will actually make this happen so people don't even realize they're being agile.
Or create the conditions where people can show up.
Yeah, exactly. So it happens. So that's the thing. So sometimes it's one measurement. So, you know, if you want to eat less sugar, as a human, you know, as a person, what is the one thing you could measure daily that would stop you from eating that sugar and maybe helps you change your environment before you have to fix yourself?
I can give you an example. For me, I'm very addicted to sugar. And for me, it was the smaller the time span is while I'm eating, so intermittent fasting, the lower my sugar is. Intermittent fasting.
Yeah.
Fasting, and when I, as you could see, I was in hospital, and when I talked to the doctor, and he talked about my blood, he was asking me, Michael, what are you doing? You have very, very low sugar and you have very good blood. I just do intermediate fasting. And this is my, to try as often as possible in the week to eat not for 16 hours. So it's the 16-8.
And that triggers something in my head, because I go, okay, so what reflective process is going on in your head? Yeah. That means at the end of the week, you look back at the week and say, could I be better next week?
Yes.
Where can I allow myself a little bit of sugar because you have a birthday coming?
I use an app.
There we go.
Yeah, and because I'm addicted to sugar, it does not work to say I don't eat sugar. No. it just helps, reduce the time where you eat. Exactly. And then the whole cells are without sugar.
Well, that's exactly. Do you see what I mean? Yeah. Get the data that matters.
I got it.
And the performance then is a byproduct, The reduction of sugar or engagement or, attracting talent. Those are byproducts of something. Those are not in and of themselves things we should be measuring. those are outcomes of something else.
Well, what could be data? I mean, I'm thinking when my last company was growing fast, we went from 20 to 100 in something like 18 months or so. Mm-hmm. And I remember the biggest issue was that you had younger people, not that experienced, bringing, and everyone does it. I'm not saying that the old people don't do it, bringing their emotional energy. Of course, they should do, but unreflected to the team in that moment. And it was like exploding in the middle of a team. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know, I didn't have the idea to how to solve that. And then we said, like, why don't we make a little flashlight saying red, green, yellow, in terms of that's my emotional mode. Wasn't the best idea, but it was an idea. And Red then said, this
don't
is gonna
talk
be,
to me
don't
today.
Don't talk to me today. It's going to be a rough day. The weekend was really bad. Yeah. No, I'm just taking that as an example because it's okay. So difficult to measure these things. Like, yeah. What would you
do? So let me describe what your tool did. So like when you start looking at tools, one of the things people don't realize is what are you trying to do? And because we still have I don't want to criticize now the world of psychology, but they still come with the lens from the 1960s. So put another lens on that one. Okay, so when you're working with traffic lights, very often what you're doing is using a binary sort of scale to tell somebody. Now, if you take, for example, this, a lens which maybe comes from anthropology, in this sense, they will look at that and go, hang on, what you're trying to do is warn people up front in the group of something. And the minute you warn somebody up front, you create a negotiation perspective. And that negotiation perspective is, this person's not happy today. Can I take another approach to work with this person? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's what you're doing with that tool. So the thing what we do is then I go back even further and say, well, look, how can I help you? What is it you want us, what would you like here to happen? So people are bringing in some raw emotion. Well, first of all, what's wrong with raw emotion? Why are you trying to put it into wrong and right first? So before I can even begin with you, I have to get you to turn off your black box of what you see through your bias as a leader, mm-hmm. what right and wrong is. So let's turn that box off first. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is, when the minute you do that, new solutions come to your head. It's really funny how the brain works. So the minute I get you to turn off your black box, then suddenly you sit there and go, so I could try this in. And I said, well, let's try that. And it could be something completely different. And that is something where when people come to me and say, I'm a coach, and then I see them coach people and I say, no, not you're a consultant. And you can see that. And I think that is the problem that you very often find with issues like that, is that people come along because you must have got, either you saw that or someone gave you that to you as advice, but you didn't really listen to yourself properly. Because you had this, so you got the solution in your head.
I give you the involvement of that now. Yeah. We now have team talks, and we, of course, I'm just taking this as black and white examples, okay? So we had one colleague, for example, he was very unhappy, very upset. And of course, you, like, I first looked, what's wrong with the job? What's wrong with the team? What should we do? And then I think it was Katinka who found out that, it was Nils. I don't know, it doesn't really matter. Found out, like, he had two cats, and like the one cat was new, and they didn't like each other, and they were fighting all night. They were fighting all night, and he couldn't do his job anymore.
Can I?
I'm like, let me give you a look. Yeah, but for him, it was a real big issue, and we helped him to solve that at home.
And then the energy flew. So there's from the early 50s, there was a wonderful philosopher from I can't remember his name at the moment, an Austrian philosopher. And he looked at the concept of freedom. You know, what you put in is what you get out. But out of that, and then some systemic theory that came along around that time, from Central Europe and from the UK and America through people like Bateson, there was a thinking that came up, like, could we take the energy out of a distress situation and use it to solve the problem? Yeah. So the German word I like a lot is the word Not, which has 26 translations into English. It can mean emergency. It can mean poverty. It can mean so many things. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, what you did there was you took the distress that was currently surfaced as the most important. You made it be heard at the table. You dealt with it. And the minute that happens, the output just increases tenfold. Mm-hmm. So what your traffic light evolved into was actually a very old way of listening. And not listening to fix, but listening to hear. Mm-hmm. So that's what you did there. Just to give you mm-hmm. what I heard out of what you were saying. So you went from listening to fix, which you try to do with the traffic light, mm-hmm. to let's sit here and just listen and hear and see if we can help him.
Mm-hmm. What could be, because you said technology wasn't there 15 years ago when you came up with the idea, like what kind of technology do you use to measure when you think about these things?
Well, we have these supercomputers in our pocket.
I have one as well.
Yeah, I
think one that is way more performant than the one.
These are definitely assisting the listening process of what you were just talking about. And I think that that's what we're trying to do. How can we do a better job of listening to what the system is saying to us so that it can self-correct and then feed it back that information so that it can do these things. It can intervene in these ways. It can have different discussions. It can increase the quality of the conversation that we're having here at the table to increase the speed of which, how the energy is moving here. Yeah. And I think that that's what we're trying to unlock. Is the data or is what we're feeding back into the system helpful to the system so it can self-evolve? Because as you were saying, you know, you have these people who think that they have the answer, but, you know, the system has its own answers. The team knows what to do. The team usually knows where the issues are. It's just not asking itself the right questions.
So you're measuring or you're recording voice and you analyze?
No, it's all very highly visual. So it's a set of questions. So for example, we have psychological safety. We're looking
It's an app.
It's a web-based application. So you would ask, we're asked a series of questions around psychological safety, and that involves...
Every team member would get the same set of questions?
Yeah. Every team gets the same set of questions, and it's visually displayed on a plot graph, and you can see where you've answered, where the team answered, where everybody else has answered. And it gives you some recommendations, some questions to discuss. The questions in and of themselves that are being asked are also grounds for reflection. Yeah. So do we help you learn and grow?
Yeah.
For example.
And then there's a
slider on the side and there's a plant that blooms or it dies. Right. And so what we're asking people to do is not ask on a scale of 1 to 7, do we help you learn and grow? Because you're 6 and my 6 are 2 different things. Yeah. It's a subjective, it's a very subjective thing. But if I can look at a plant and I can see it bloom and grow, I can feel that almost internally as I scrub it. Every time I take the different quizzes, I'm like, you know, I do take a deep breath and I ask myself, okay, what does this feel like today for me?
Yeah. Okay.
Or in this context, what does it feel like for me? And I'm asking now people to access the limbic system. I'm asking them to get out of the cerebral cortex. I'm asking them to answer from different parts of the brain. Yeah. Or the body actually is what I'm asking them to do. Or we're asking them to do. And when you get now 6 or 7 of these kinds of questions, I get a more accurate data point, or we think it's a more accurate data point of what's actually happening within the context of the team.
Hier kommt die ganz kurze Werbeunterbrechung und diesmal geht es wieder um ein eigenes Thema, aber um ein Herzensthema von Michael. Nämlich, wir dürfen mit dem On the Way to New Work Podcast ein Stipendium mitvergeben für die Exponential University, in kurz die XU University. Das ist nicht irgendeine Uni, die wird neu gegründet, beziehungsweise ist gegründet, startet im April und hat Dozenten wie Lars Hinrichs, Julia von Winterfeld, Claude Ritter, also auch Leute, die ihr aus dem Podcast kennt, denn es dreht sich im Kern um Digital Business, Coding, Software, Engineering, alles, was man für digitale Transformation braucht. Das macht diese Universität. Und ganz konkret könnt ihr euch bewerben für ein Stipendium. Und zwar in einem sehr ordentlichen Wert. Also schaut mal drauf, nämlich dieses Stipendium können wir unterstützen unter step-forward-xu.com und die Infos für die Uni findet ihr auf xu-university.com. Super spannend, wie gesagt, absolut ein Thema der Zeit. Das ist etwas, was uns täglich immer wieder beschäftigt, sehr speziell als Studiengang, aber eben mit unfassbar spannenden Dozenten und so ein Stipendium kriegt man ja nicht mehr ebenso. Ganz kleine Sache, der Anmeldeschluss ist bis zum 15.04. Das heißt, ihr solltet jetzt Gas geben, wenn ihr sagt, das ist etwas für mich, da schaue ich mal rein. Jetzt geht's weiter mit der Folge.
One of the things which I've realized, I travel the world and visit places like you do, and one of the most fascinating places was Atlanta, where I went to a hospital, the world's best hospital for paraplegic people. You know, when you're paralyzed from the neck down.
Atlanta, Georgia?
Yeah. Atlanta, Georgia, yeah, exactly. And there I went to the best hospital in the world. They have a 99% success rate of bringing people back into life. When you walk into the hospital, the first thing you see is an Olympic-sized swimming pool. You see a basketball, and you're sitting there thinking, what's going on here? People have had tragic accidents, tragic events, which has led them to be confined to a wheelchair, whatever led to it. And I had a lovely afternoon with a wonderful head nurse, and we were drinking wine on the balcony upstairs. And And then I said, so look, I'm just fascinated by the work you're doing, and I see the dedication. You feel, I wouldn't even say the passion, but you see the sincerity in every nurse that is on the floor working with these people. And I kept saying, it's not the machinery doing it. It's not the machinery. All the best equipment is not doing it. And then she said a sentence which I'd never heard from any top leader or anybody in business say. She says, Imran, look, the only tool we have as human to navigate complexity with is emotion. So the minute we get over the concept that emotion is something bad or wrong or right and realize nature took millions of years to give us a tool to help us navigate it, at that point you will start learning how to deal with people better. And I took that sentence away and I started working with that and I started realizing she's right. It's the best tool nature has given us. It's taken millions of years to create. Why are we trying to create tools that beats nature? Mm. Nature's got 300 million years on us. And why don't we really look at it? And what we do is, oh, you're being emotional. No, the person is not being emotional. The person's already angry with you and has been angry with you for the last 2 years, but you never give them an opportunity to tell you that you are being an asshole. That's why they're being emotional. Do you get that as the leader of the team?
And it's there. I mean, and the thing is there, and the tension then, you know, creates this huge issue. Yeah. And people avoid and ignore. And those are the things that rip teams apart. I mean, we've seen it happen. Yeah. And even, and the inability to deal with the emotion actually and process that emotion, allow it to flow through the system so that it can actually then work. And there is no friction then between the parts. Yeah. We increase the quality of the relationship by dealing and addressing that, but through vulnerability, through just, you know, asking and caring about what's going on the other side of the table and pretending that, you know, that's an actual human being over there and not a robot.
That gets me into a really fascinating thought. I don't know if this, but one of our investors, Dirk Freitag, said to us, guys, look, you embody bias. You as men will embody a bias as men. And whatever organizational structure you build, your product will mirror that. Mm-hmm. That's why we wanted Dirk as our investor, straight up. Mm-hmm. And because as a German man who's also around his 50, he realizes his internal bias as a man. And he knows that if you create a structure, your product will carry that bias. Full stop, end of story. And we said, well, how do we work against that? How do we build an organization structure that reflects what the product needs to reflect? And that's where we put Sabina and Verena, design to lead product. Data and tech. Say, well, you lead product. So, because we find creativity is what is the glue that brings data and tech together. And what's coming out of that is a really healthy discussion. Like you and Sabina, you guys got each other. It's fascinating.
Well, I love it. I love the tension though. And I think we dive into it. We don't ignore the tension, but we confront it and
deal with it.
And it's through a lens of we're both in service of this thing working. Yeah. We're both in service of something higher, and it's not about her or myself or the, what's created there, but it's dealing with directly the tension associated with that and moving through it. And that's where you get really interesting insights and creation and collaborative, insight that you use to build really cool things. Yeah. We tend to avoid that in most teams.
Yeah.
Because of the,
Oh, do you know what I call it? Yeah. I always call this culture of niceness, mm-hmm. where you have brittle kisses. Brittle kisses, kisses that fall to pieces the minute you, and they fall to pieces afterwards. And I prefer a culture of kindness, where if I'm being kind to you, I will tell you when you hurt me.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping you will tell me if you hurt me.
But this is a bias as well, because I like this bias, because I tend to say I would love to work in a company like this as well. But if you have, let's say, a very German company, big, 100,000 people, which has another approach, can they use your product as well? Because they say, well, my understanding or our understanding is a little bit different. We are not.
That's actually a really good question.
We are straight, clear, but rely on me. But
it's interesting that you say that. I mean, I've worked for lots of companies like that in Germany. I found them very human. Mm-hmm. I found them very clear on the ethics. Everybody knew where they were. There was clarity. Mm-hmm. And one of the things which I find is really, really key is there was no concept of high performance. There was just optimal performance in the context. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think that's the difference. There is no, they're able to say, this is the best we can do. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. That's optimal. That's it, done. And I find that is where we can help them completely, because we can help the teams get to optimal performance in the conditions they're in. Mm-hmm. So like, it's, you know, it's like, do you want to be creative in the box or do you want to be creative outside the box? Most companies need to be creative inside the box.
Is your product an AI coach?
Not yet.
But it's what you want to...
Yeah, because if we could find the data sets that could make that AI coach now, mm-hmm. we would, but there isn't. There isn't
in the anywhere. Capital.
There is no AI. All the people that
are currently... But you work with machine learning.
So well, no, we're heading towards that. We want to do adaptive learning, which I find is... So the questions change as you go along. Yeah. But you can't do that unless...
You've got a good data set.
Good data. I mean, I grew up programming. Yeah. So every HR, every startup I meet... around the globe who say we're a HR company, we're using AI data, 101,400,000 data points to collect human data and make guesses. I'm like saying, really? Are you? What data sets are you using? And that data set, what is it based on? What thinking is it based on? Because what I find very often, there is a very, very one-sided bias on that data. Very, very one-sided.
It's top-down. It's very top-down. It's from an organizational perspective. Is the human performing the way we want the human to perform?
Exactly. It's still that mindset. It's the parenting mindset.
Do they show up in their own fruition and want to contribute and add value here?
We don't have that data. Nobody has it.
We don't have that information.
And I've been talking to all the supercomputers around Europe. I mean, all the supercomputers in Europe are sitting and not doing the work they should be doing because there aren't enough data sets. So we're all collecting the wrong data.
Yeah, we're very much top down oriented, and I think that when we move to increase the speed of where we need to head to, it will be bottom up. Yeah, it will be self organized bottom up teams that drive organizations.
Yes, that's what I think.
Very quick and very dynamic and alive. Yeah, like organisms as we are. but a collective sense of the organism. Yeah, and it moves and it's dynamic and it changes and it rotates and things die off and new things come to life. It's like, it's a very alive thing. And when you look at a lot, if I've been to some creative agencies and you watch people work, just feel how they're working or feel what the environment feels like when you're in it. Sometimes it's very stale and dead. And that energy is the input to the things that they're building. So you ask me if it's going to be innovative and creative. I just say, let me see their process. Mm. Let me see the quality of the process and the energy that's going into building the thing. What does it feel like? And I'll tell you how good the tool is going to be on the back end of it. Mm. Because I've seen it before. I've seen it, you know, in real life in my innovation work in San Francisco, building the agency there.
I really believe strongly that what you're doing is right. I just a little anecdote. A couple of weeks ago, I talked to the two founders of Springer and Jacobi, which was the leading agency, or one of the leading agencies in Germany. I worked there for 5 years. They both are around 70 now. And they were always very proud that their company had a very strong culture. And they said, we believe that companies with a strong culture, with people who are proud to work in their company, mm-hmm. have a good feeling for their team, like their team, are more successful than others. And then they say, well, we should build up an investing tool. A fund, do you say in English, a fund?
A fund.
Investment fund, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they went to investment fund companies and told the idea. I said, well, we want to invest in companies where people are proud to work in their company. We believe that they perform better. And there were just laughs. So, no data. We don't believe this. And then there was one company in Hamburg, Hansa Invest. They said, well, do you think there's any data we could use to make a back projection? And say, well, yeah, there's an organization called Great Place to Work. Mm-hmm. They measure lots of criterias, and they come up with a list. I think right now the Salesforce is the best place to work for in the world. So, and then they have country organizations, and then they said, okay, we take this list, which is done since years, and they compared. 15 years ago, the DAX, the German index, the MSCI World index, and the Great Place to Work. And it was by far the best. Mm-hmm. And then they started this now, and they have now a proud at Work fund, backed by a Great Place to Work with the license. And it's interesting to see that there's proof of
not just in Great Places to Work, but you're also seeing these kinds of analysis done on diversity as well, too. So women-led companies or representation of that. There's a different element that the female energy brings to the dynamic of the table that you need. It brings the other half of the masculine that we're missing in the organization, what we're trying to highlight and value again. And saying these things that we've been devaluing since the turn of the century actually need to be introduced back into organizations.
Yeah, I mean, personal experience, I don't think I'd be sitting here today if I had not been allowed into the English Gentlemen's Club. Mm-hmm. I mean, I come from a place in the world where I grew up in the East End of London. We were working class, even though my father was a technical electrician. You go into the workforce and my options are not the same as a white man standing next to me, who's also done a law degree. Yeah, they're not. Like the options between my son and my daughter are defined by birth. My daughter has less options than my son, not because of their education, not because of their background, because one is female, one is male. These biases are there. If you come from a certain part of Germany and you come from another part of Germany, you might look the same, but your options change depending on the way maybe your accent is.
Or your first name.
Do you see that? I mean, these biases are there, and we're not trying to. I'm not trying to ignore them, but that is what I'm about.
They just impede great teams.
Gets me out of bed every day. Discrimination of that sort gets me out of bed every day on a daily basis because I see it everywhere. I see it when I first came to Germany in 1995 when I started in my first leadership position. I saw the discrimination going on in German organizations, but it wasn't just skin color discrimination. There was ageism going on. There was, oh, he's a marketing person, or, oh God, oh, account, you know. No, but you do it. I was surprised when my first couple of weeks in Vienna, I went to a party. It was about startups and people working. It was called Initiative Neue Wirtschaft. So for Einzelperson Unternehmen. So, you know, people who are setting up different types of business ideas and models and testing out how could I be a one person show. And everybody kept on using the word Werber, marketing person, saying, but using it negatively. And I couldn't understand it. And then I went home that evening with my wife and I said, Sabina, could you explain this to me? He says, oh yeah, it's like, how can I say it? It's like a Schimpfwort. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, he's a bit like a Werber, you know, he's a typical Werber. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, but what does it mean stereotypically? It's like the English can't cook.
Yeah. But, which is bullshit.
Which is complete and utter rubbish because that is what stops then agencies from getting great talent because everybody sees an agency and puts them all into one position where there are agencies like where we are today. Grab some partner where they are doing great culture work and they are moving things.
So one big thing that goes through my head when you say this is also the bias we put into certain things we do for ourselves. And you said that at a certain point you realized for yourself, I'm by heart not a lawyer. And realizing something like that is a gift for most of the people. I would claim many, many people never realize that at all. Mm-hmm. We had Fridjof who's always like saying the sentence, find out what you really, really want. What do you really, really want?
It's a core idea, helping people.
Where does that come from? Where does that emerge from though? And I think it's that listening.
Where is that coming from? And that's my question, like theoretically, but like from your experience, you had that moment. How did this moment come? How did it influence the work? And how does it influence this work with the team? Because if I come every morning and I don't have the feeling I don't belong here, but I cannot feel it.
I can tell you the story that led it. Mm-hmm. I can tell you, I know exactly the point it happened. And I know it has to do with realizing something that has 500-600 years of history behind it. And it was, my great aunties in London are phenomenally good lawyers. They're very high up. One is now the first Asian member of parliament in the UK. Yasmin is the first brown woman to become a member of parliament in British government. Azra was a top-notch prosecutor for the government. And Yasmin invited me to one of the inns, which is a very elite organization where you are a barrister, and a barrister is the lawyer who can stand in court and speak. Mm. And I went along and I went to have lunch with her because she wanted to show me, Imran, this is where you will come as a lawyer. So, and then the first thing I realized, I came in, I sat down and there was no menu. Everybody knew the menu. I didn't know the menu. So I felt excluded already. I said, oh, I see how you keep people out of here. Then I chose, she told me what was the best thing on the menu today. I ordered that. I trusted her. That was the first step of me coming into the group. We had our lunch. We finished. And then I said, okay. I said, Auntie, I'll invite you. It was a wonderful talk. Love you to bits. I want to pay and get out of this place. I hate it. And then she says, Imran, there is no menu. You go up to the lady who sits there at the cashier and you tell her what you've had out of honesty. She says, why do we have to be honest? Why don't we lie? Why don't we tell her we just had 2 cups of tea, pay our £1.50 and go? You don't do that here. You're honest. And then as I went up and we paid and we told her, I didn't realize that the judges sat 30 centimeters above the normal barristers, higher. And all this created the culture of elitism for me. Mm-hmm. And in that moment, I knew this is exactly what I think breaks humans. This is exactly what the British did in the imperial business model they used on India, my grandparents' grandparents. Wow. Mm-hmm. This is it. The connection came so clear. All the years of looking at history, reading the books, understanding why people would always say to me, Imran, oh, I don't like Indians and Pakistanis, but you're different. That's that realization. And allowing that to, and then I had great mentors and coaches all through my life, and they helped me to realize. And I think there's two things, an event, number one, and secondly, making sure you're never arrogant enough not to have a coach or a mentor in your life.
You need that reflection.
You need that. I still have two coaches today.
We all need that reflection back. And are we aligned with where we need to be? Are we doing what it is that we need to do? Are we showing up as we need to show up? Do we have people around us that call us out on our shit? That's it. And are we listening to that?
Yeah? I don't think you can see
and you can't, your can't inner see strength. It sometimes. You can't see your own biases. You can't see when sometimes you're a little bit off track.
Well, your strengths.
Unless you have a really deep practice that you can continually call on that allows you to stay in that coherence. Yeah. And I don't think a lot of people have that. They don't have the discipline for it. So we need people then around us to allow us to see those things that we can't see.
And the interesting thing is you guys have the coach at hand who most of the people trust the most. I mean, in this thing, you're vulnerable because you type everything in there. Every secret is in here. People keep everything in here.
That's what we hope.
And we trust it because we look at it all day long,
right? Yeah. That's the idea. You know, you share things with your phone that you don't share with regular people. And I think that there is some intimacy there.
Definitely.
There is some intimacy that we're hoping people will open up to and really express. And if it's anonymous, if they feel it's anonymous, hopefully, which we've done a good job of trying to definitely protect people's anonymity through the whole process while creating some clarity about what's actually happening within the collective.
I've got a question for you guys, man. So your agencies are how big? I don't know how big your agencies are.
So Christoph is a consultant. He has a company of 25 people.
You say this with a biased.
No. But it's more. As I started my career as a management consultant, I start with you because it's... you have higher fees.
I had a bias on consultant, but since you say this with so much kindness, I really learned to love myself as a consultant.
I struggled with that for years.
25 well. People in your organization?
Yeah.
And my first company, there are 450 people in the agency, and I now started a new business, sports marketing, where we are 15 people, which is totally different dynamic again. It's a team which really behaves as a team. Very often the case is when you start something new, everyone loves the idea. They work damn hard without you have to tell them to do so. They live the product. They come every day excited. As we create our own sport events, they come 10 weekends.
Sounds lovely.
10 weekends during winter time to make this happen. And I think if you have a good why, a good purpose in your company, a good product, then it's much, much easier to let people themselves develop into it.
Yeah, see, and that's the question the reason I asked that question was just imagine, you know, the why, very often we would have how do you fill your environment with your why? And that is always a question which I think is really important. Like, it's not just having the why, but our job is also to fill the environment with the right sentences that we live for. Like, some of the best high performing teams I know in the world, like, you know, the All Blacks, the New Zealand, they have I played rugby for 11 years, but what I like about rugby always was there was a very clear sentence that drove the whole team. And for the All Blacks, it's like, if you're not growing, you're not going anywhere. And for me, the question always is, if we could measure the one data point in your group of 15 that continuously either helped the purpose to change as the team changes. Mm-hmm. So 450 people got the data straight away in an instant, and the conversation started and said, is it time for our purpose to move? And if it is going to move, how little is it going to adjust? Same for you. Mm-hmm. And that real-timeness of moving a concept like purpose in a group of people, for me, is some of the best and most healthiest conversations and kills all negative political talk.
Yeah.
It kills it. It fills up all the vacuums. And what we don't have at the moment, what we have at the moment, our question is that Mitarbeiterbefragung, Zufriedenheit. And then, exactly. I only got one standing ovation in my life. And that was on a stage where I killed the questionnaire. I put RIP on top of a Mitarbeiterbefragung. Mm. And all the people stood up and gave me a standing ovation for 3 minutes.
It's too slow.
We learned from Xing, which is the German equivalent to LinkedIn. They have something. They ask their employees every week, what is the one thing you feel with the organization internally and externally, and is it a thumbs up or thumb down feeling?
That already helps.
And then the CEO, then you can vote. It's open to everyone. Everyone can take part. They can see, oh, wow, this is, I give a vote. And then the CEO raises the top five points in their outside performance and in the inside, and explains it and says, well, thank you for sharing this with us. We will do this and that. Or maybe I didn't explain this carefully enough because we can't change it because it's legal or blah, blah. So every week, sometimes it's five top issues, sometimes it's five sad issues, but they told us with just doing it, it's just a tweet, just 140, and I think it's much, much better and more intuitive than asking them 60 questions once a year and then waiting 3 months with the first indication of results and then another 3 months with the results and then, yeah, then.
Well, it's the end of the day, people want to be heard.
Yeah.
And I have to be heard here now. We are again hitting the hour. It's going so fast, and I don't know why we planned this so tight today, but we're rushing through. We already came too late to you guys.
We come back again.
Definitely. So let's finish with something that we think is very important. And I'm pretty sure you guys have a great answer. We always ask for the best reads that you guys had in your life, the best books. I don't know which data points you use for measuring that, but if you would give a personal recommendation and say, okay, Christoph, if you go home this weekend, this is the one book you definitely have to read.
Well, I have two in my head, but I'm going to pick for the one that
you can pick up to five. Okay, but I'll number one needs to be your like.
Okay, the one which I think we should spend. She only wrote one book. She never wrote a second book. It's Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird.
To Kill a Mockingbird.
Mm. It's the story of Atticus Finch and his children growing up in the States, and how they deal with the racism.
Wow.
And getting to know humans. And I think if that could become the core reading part of, let's get rid of leadership programs and let's make sure leaders start reading books like Harper Lee, To Kill a Mockingbird, to start understanding how we still are as humans and how we're not moving as leaders.
And you see the sum comes out very strong. That's the first
book. The second book is a bit of a philosophical book, but it's about systems thinking. And I think the current thinking to help everybody, whether it's old or young, it's a book which is trying to look at history from a non-linear aspect. It's called 1,000 Years of Non-Linear History by Delander. And it's based on Deleuzian philosophy, but looks at the flow of energy in nature, in cities, and explains the history like history really is. It's non-linear. It's not a straight line. And nobody's to blame for anything.
Definitely. Nice. Both are new on our list. Thanks for sharing.
Sean, how about you?
Yeah.
You now have time.
I've got two. I've got two as well. My first one is The Untethered Soul by Michael Singer. It takes a lot of really dense kind of spiritual, esoteric things and kind of an instruction guide for the human being that I think is an amazing kind of ground level book for people to read on their life journeys. My second one is Skin in the Game by Nassim Taleb. I think we just need a lot more doers out there at this point in time. We need people doing stuff. We're getting late in the game here for humanity, and I want to have hope for the humans, and we just need people out there trying to make it better.
Thank you guys for such a wonderful conversation.
Yeah.
A lot of inspiration, a lot of out of the box thoughts. And it was good to see you. Yeah.
Hopefully we've been able to synthesize some of that into the tools. Yeah. As best we can.
We are. Thank you guys as well.
Thank you guys.
And I will have to finish because there's no Kokoro.com. It's bkokoro.com.
That's right. Integrated.
I think people will
ask for that.
Ask for it, and we'll get in contact with you.
Great.
To be sure about this.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you guys.
This is a nice hour. Thank you.